The following presentation was recorded at the Buddhist Society of Victoria, Malvern East, Australia. Please visit our website at bsv.net.au.
Okay, so let's get on to the questions. Starting from the top, dear Ajahn, any advice or tips to reduce random thoughts and quiet the mind faster? I feel it takes so long by the time thought settled meditation is over. Sometimes can't even be quiet within my allocated time. One way that helps a bit is to feel I'm dying or I'm in samadhi, although not really, but by thinking that, it immediately reduces a lot of thoughts and you become peaceful. Yes, that is one of the purposes of the death contemplation, is to reduce the thinking mind and become peaceful. So if that works, you can always come back to the death contemplation. Yeah, and the idea, of course, is that we can die at any time, and unless you are ready now, you're very likely never really to be ready for this anyway. So it's a very useful contemplation to kind of for making you peaceful specifically. In the face of death, it doesn't make any sense to have any desires related to this world or any ill will and all of that. So it's quite nice way of letting go of everything here. So that is useful. You can also just look at those thoughts and look at the content, what it is about. And just remind yourself that a lot of the things that we think about are, that there's nothing really necessarily of interest in that world. Often we look at problems that we have to resolve or issues that we have to deal with at work or in a family life or whatever it is. And very often there is just another problem after another problem coming up again. You resolve one, there's more problems down the line. It's endless. So you realize there is no real solution in that realm. There is no final way out of it. And the only real solution is actually to become quiet here and now. So just understanding the limits of that world, that there isn't any point to it. But if death contemplation works for you, please do that, because it can often be very, very, make a lot of peace in your mind. The other thing is to make the meditation more attractive, so that it becomes more interesting just to stay with the peace or with the breath or whatever. And to do that, you just have to look for the attractive side of meditation practice. Look for the beauty of the peace, look for any piti sukha that may arise or whatever it is. And the more you see that, the more you see that letting go of the burdens of the world and meditation is something beautiful, the mind will incline towards that. All of these things take time, so you have to be very patient. Even being able to do the death contemplation properly can be quite takes time often before it bites. So you often have to actually try these things out. And sometimes it may be very useful to have a guided meditation to help you. Because that, I don't know, many people just, if you have the right kind of voice, the right kind of person, someone you trust, someone you feel inspired by, and everybody tends to have some people who inspire them, then listen to that voice, and often that can kind of transport you into a peaceful state quite quickly, because of that feeling, that depth of spiritual qualities or whatever that a person may have. So they can be very useful. I have often found that myself, just listening to the right person can actually be very powerful and very useful. So try some of those things, and over time you will be able to find things that work for you, hopefully. Okay. Dear Ajahn, Buddhism and Hinduism have lots of similarities, like samsara, samadhi, etc., the unborn. But Hinduism says liberation is self-realization, where the self is all-encompassing, which includes everything within and without nature. Self, non-self, emptiness, nothingness, everything is encapsulated in the word self. But mainly referring to the nature of nature. Okay. Since it's just a label word but represents non-self in Buddhism, is it the same in your opinion? If not, then how come there are many awakened yogis throughout time which exist before Buddhism, and people are able to follow the path of liberation as well? To me, it feels the same, like how all rivers lead to the ocean. Okay, well, the first problem here is this idea of there are many awakened yogis throughout time. Well, what does it mean, awakened, and how do we know that they are really awakened, and to what extent are they awakened, and what does awakening mean in the different traditions? And this is very, you know, you really have to define your terms very carefully here to know what you're talking about. Awakening in Buddhism means something else than awakening in Advaita Vedanta, for example, you know, non-duality Hindu traditions. It means very different things. In one place, awakening is roughly equivalent to what we call samadhi in Buddhism. Because samadhi is a very profound state, and because it is so profound, it is very natural to take samadhi as awakening itself. When you reach kind of something that feels like the meaning of life, where there is no more movement at all, when you just experience, you know, undiluted, continuous bliss for hours on end, where the sense of that yourself has been abandoned. This is why they call it non-self in these things, because the experience is pretty much that there is no self there. Yeah, the experience is one where you of unity with everything, of no differentiation between things. And because of that, it feels very similar to what Nibbana might be described in Buddhism. Yeah, you can very easily interpret those experiences in that sense. But it doesn't mean it is the same thing. Yeah? And this is kind of remember, the Buddha existed in a very similar kind of climate in ancient India, you had these teachings that are very similar in many ways to modern teachings about, you know, samadhi being the goal of the path and these kind of things. And the Buddha practiced in that way as well before his own awakening. But instead of taking these things as the goal, which is natural if you believe in a god or something already, everything becomes unified, everything comes together. He asked, well, is this really the end? And from his point of view, what he discovered is that no, because it just leads to more rebirth in the future. You don't stay there. You don't stay in that state forever. It only lasts so long. Then you come out of it and you carry on again. This is kind of part of the Buddha's discovery of, you know, rebirth and karma. So he asked, is there something beyond this? Is there a real end to this thing we call samsara, a real end to rebirth? This doesn't actually end rebirth from a Buddhist point of view. This is where Buddhism is different. Yeah. So from the Buddhist point of view, the awakening experience is actually beyond that. Even that experience you can take as a self afterwards. When you come out of it, you will say that is a self. This is why in the Hindu system, they call it the Atman and the Brahman kind of coming together. This is kind of the experience. They call it the Atman and the Brahman, the real self, if you like, or the universal self. Similar to the kind of things that you may experience in some other mystical traditions also. But the Buddha says you have to go beyond that. You have to go to the complete emptiness, which is beyond even that. So this is where the Buddha specifically says that Buddhism is different, because it takes the non-self idea to its very limit, to its very conclusion, and that's the distinction. This is really where the difference comes in. Otherwise, as you say, they would be pretty much the same, all of these things. It's important to make these kind of distinctions, because if we don't make these kind of distinctions, then indeed it looks like all rivers lead to the ocean, but the things aren't always the same. There's lots of things in common, but not exactly the same. Okay. Dear Ajahn, from your understanding, what is the difference between the Buddhism you teach and the Dzogchen teachings, views, and meditation techniques? I've been keen to explore Dzogchen, but would like to understand the core difference from your experience. Thank you. I don't really know much about Dzogchen, to be honest with you. It's kind of a mindfulness practice or something like that. But I don't really know. This is a Tibetan a teaching. Probably there's lots in common. Yeah, I can't really say. There's a mindfulness teaching that ultimately probably leads to some kind of stillness of the mind, maybe samadhi. But I cannot really tell you enough to really know what it is, to really give you any kind of informed understanding of that. Unfortunately, I have kind of been happy. Because the reason is simply because I tend to go back to the word of the Buddha and I look at those teachings. That's what I find interesting. And I haven't really explored or read much about the other teachings. So I can't really say. Okay. You know anything about Dzogchen teachings? No? Okay, yeah, no. We are an ignorant Sangha members. We don't know about these things. Ajahn, please define samadhi stillness. One, is it the first jhana and beyond, on the stages before when you lose awareness of the body? Thank you for the teachings. Well, samadhi and stillness is a gradual thing, yeah, like so many things. So it is really a matter of, you can say that there is some degree of stillness. Obviously, stillness is something which goes deeper and deeper and deeper. So you could maybe argue that there is a degree of samadhi before you get to the jhana stage, yeah, when the mind is very one-pointed on the object. Samadhi is defined in the suttas as non-distractedness, yeah? So the mind is not being distracted by the five senses or by thoughts or by whatever, but it's kind of staying with one object. That's how samadhi is defined. There's many definitions, that's one of them. Avikitta citta, non-distracted mind. Ekagata citta, the one-pointed mind. So that is one definition, but the samma samadhi, the samadhi in the Noble Eightfold Path, which may be what we're talking about now, because we're looking at the Fourth Noble Truth, then it is defined as the jhana states, yeah, the four jhanas specifically. And so that's what it is there. So it is a matter of degree, but ideally, as part of this practice, eventually you want to get to the point where the mind is as unified as possible and as peaceful as possible, including the jhanas, if you keep on practicing long enough. So it's a gradual thing, and it also includes the jhanas down the track. And that's kind of where this path is heading eventually. Ajahn, thank you for your teachings this week. What internal speech do you use to address not being over compassionate towards others? What do you say when resentment arises? I know this is in the past, but if you could recall, I would appreciate your sharing to help me here. Condolences on the loss of your sister. May she progress along the path. Okay. You can't really be over compassionate, I suppose. I suppose that you are maybe stretching your limited resources too much to the point where you actually maybe lose the compassion resentment arises. So you have to know your limits. Yeah, you have to know how much you can do. And if you feel that it goes too far, you're stretching yourself too thin, over too much, then just pull back a little bit, and do some more meditation, recharge your batteries, do what you have to do to re-establish again those good qualities inside of you. Otherwise, it's not going to work out in the long run. You have to have those good qualities to be able to share them with others. Otherwise, there's nothing there to share. So you have to kind of establish yourself first of all. So just know your limits, pull back. Okay, now I need time to look after myself and kind of build up these good qualities again. Resentment arising means that you are probably like kind of maybe allowing yourself to be manipulated a little bit by others or something like that. And then when you allow that to happen, then of course it's very easy to feel resentful because of that. So don't allow others to manipulate you. You should decide what the right time is to be compassionate and caring, and try not to allow the people to kind of boss you around too much, because it just leads to, as you say, problems. Hopefully that's what you are asking. Okay. Uh, Dear Ajahn, what type of Buddhist teachings is considered Theravada? Is what you are teaching referred to as Theravada? What is the difference between orthodox Theravada? Thank you. Well, Theravada is really a school of Buddhism. Yes, there are many schools of Buddhism, and Buddhism kind of divided up into 18 schools is the kind of the number that is often quoted from in ancient India. It's probably not exactly 18, but that's kind of an accepted number. It probably was more than that. And Theravada became one of those schools, and the school that got established in Sri Lanka is the Theravadan school. And a Theravadan school has certain scriptures that belong to that school, a Theravadan Abhidhamma, Visuddhimagga, commentaries, sub-commentaries, handbooks of Abhidhamma, and all kind of stuff that belongs to that school, and it don't exist in other schools of Buddhism. Yeah, that's what makes it Theravada Buddhism. So the question then is, well, what do you take as your kind of your inspiration on the Buddhist path? And what I am personally interested in is the word of the Buddha. Yeah. And I'm not so interested in things that were written by unknown authors, long time after the Buddha, because the Buddha I ultimately take as the teacher of Buddhism, of all schools of Buddhism. And that kind of opens up your idea of what the Dhamma is. It means that you look at the suttas, which are most likely to be the word of the Buddha, and then you can even use other suttas and other schools that were also passed down, because all of these come from the Buddha originally, and then it allows you to form a very clear, fairly clear picture of what the earliest form of Buddhism is by looking at all these suttas across different schools. But basically, the main thing you need to do if you want to know what early Buddhism is or the Buddha's teachings, just the four main Nikayas, Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanghita Nikaya, and Anguttara Nikaya. Long discourses, middle-length discourses, connected discourses, and numerical discourses. That's really what I would consider the core of Buddhism. And everything else is optional. And so I would often say, leave all the other things, you can leave them pretty much aside. Don't have to worry too much about that. Come back to those core teachings. Of course, in reality, it's impossible to leave all these other things completely aside, because we need a bit of commentary, we need a bit to understand these things. So for that reason, it's impossible just to read the suttas and not to listen to anything else. In a sense, you're listening to me now, so I would be hypocritical if I said just read the suttas. So maybe what I should do is just come here to Melbourne and just read the suttas, full stop. Do nothing more, That's what I'm saying. Just read the suttas. So read it out, full stop, and then remain quiet afterwards. So I'm just showing that to point out that actually it is impossible just to read the suttas. Some degree of commentary is necessary. So for that reason, you have to come back to some commentary as well. So this is what I mean by orthodox Theravada. I mean all of those scriptures that are kind of regarded as Theravada together, and instead going back to the earliest teachings. So I hope that makes sense. Dear Ajahn, yesterday you said we all need support from the Buddha in order to break through to the final state of delusion. And it's hard to do without guidance. Since the Buddha was alone at his final awakening stages, what supported him for his breakthrough? Can we actually do it alone if no support? This is an interesting question, and it's hard to really be exactly sure what happened to the Buddha, but it looks like it is possible under certain circumstances to make the breakthrough on your own. What are the qualities that are required to do that? And I think a lot of those qualities are obviously the Buddha was already, when he was born, he had very strong spiritual qualities already. Remember, according to the autobiographical account of the Buddha, he attained the jhana state as a child. So the only way you're going to do that is if you have built, probably meditated in past lives. You've probably done all kinds of things in the past to enable you to have those qualities there in his last life. And I don't think that has anything to do with the bodhisattva path. I don't really, that's a later development as far as I'm concerned. It just so happens in the world, if you look around, some people are more developed than others. Yeah, there are a few people who are very highly developed for whatever reason, because they have maybe some wisdom or whatever. So the Buddha was one of these people that was very highly developed when he was born into this world. And then on top of that, there were all these additional supporting factors. In ancient India was a very spiritual society where people were able to go forth and then be supported by society around them. It was a society where samadhi was already being practiced, so that you could practice a very long way on the path to very profound samadhi experiences, which meant that the distance to full awakening was quite short, because you already had fulfilled pretty much the Noble Eightfold Path. The only thing on the Noble Eightfold Path the Buddha had not fulfilled was which factor? The first one, yeah, samaditti, exactly. All the other factors were really fulfilled, yeah? Samaditti was missing. So once that the Buddha started to think in the right way, recall his past life, then samaditti also came into being gradually. And then when that samaditti informed the sammasamadhi, sammasamadhi, samaditti coming together, then the awakening became possible, yeah? And I think a large part of that is the recollection of past lives. Yeah, when you see that reality, it is kind of shocking. And then you understand the idea of the dukkha of the world, and then you can let it go as a consequence. So this is how that works, really. So there's a mixture of qualities that a person is built, comes with into this world, and then the supporting factors in that society. Whether it's possible to become a Buddha in contemporary Australia, I don't know. It would be quite difficult, yeah, because we don't have maybe the same kind of supporting factors. Of course, we have Buddhism, so you can still practice. So that's kind of the good thing. You don't have to become a Buddha. But if there were no Buddhism, then the question is, would it be possible for Buddhism to arise in Australia today? I have my doubts. I mean, most of the world is like that. Yeah, not just Australia, but in this present day, I think it's probably much more difficult. Maybe India would still be possible, because they still have this tradition of samanas in India. Hi, Ajahn. From your understanding, which school of Buddhism and meditation techniques is the truest to the Buddha's teachings? Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, Madhyamika, Yogacara, etc. I learned some from each, but confused to which is the most true to the Buddha's teachings. Thanks. Can you give us a brief history? So remember that all of these schools, they have things in common. Yeah, and all of these schools have things that are rooted in the word of the Buddha. And all of them also have additional things. Yeah, this is kind of the interesting point. And so sometimes, you know, we kind of think Theravada is more original than Mahayana, and there is some truth to that, but we shouldn't take it too far, because in the Mahayana, if you go to the Chinese, the Buddhist canon translated into Chinese, they also have what is called the Agamas. The Agamas are the equivalent in other schools to the Nikayas in Pali. Yeah, so in a sense, these scriptures, yeah, the core scriptures, they exist in all of these schools. The only school which has lost a lot of them is the Tibetan tradition. So Vajrayana, there is less of the early scriptures. They have some, but not all of them. So there is even more emphasis on later suttas. But it really depends on how people practice. It depends on what they take as their guidance when they practice. And one of the things I remember reading, for example, the Dalai Lama many, many years ago, some of his teachings, and actually the way he teaches is often very kind of down to earth. Teachings that are very similar to what you hear in Theravada circles, mindfulness of breathing, just being kind and compassionate and these kind of things. So a lot of it is very universal, non-self and whatever. So a lot of it is very, very much the same. Sometimes you ask the Dalai Lama, well, who is ready for the more advanced teachings? And he will say something like nobody or something like that. Yeah. So in other words, it's almost as if he's dismissing some of those more advanced teachings anyway. So it depends on who you are and how you practice these things. There's a very famous Chinese monk. He moved from mainland China to Taiwan after when Taiwan became established, and he Master Yin Shen, or something like that. I can't pronounce these things properly, but something like that. And he was very famous as a scholar, and he was kind of the one of the main people behind the inspiration behind all the large schools of Buddhism in Taiwan. Yeah, the Foguanshan, the Dharma Drum, and the Suchi Foundation. All of these were in large part inspired by him. So he was a very influential character in Taiwanese Buddhism. And he, if you asked him, he would say, well, if there is the word of the Buddha is found in the four agamas, yeah? He was a Mahayana Buddhist, but he said, this is where the word of the Buddha is found. That's very interesting, yeah? There's the greatest Mahayana scholar in modern times. That's what he would say here. So you can see this is much more diverse than sometimes what we try to make it. It is not either Theravada or Mahayana. It depends how you practice Theravada, how you practice Mahayana, which kind of makes you close to the early teachings. So no school is 100% right. No school is 100% wrong. But they're all kind of a bit there's a bit of good and a bit of bad in all of them. Having said that, Theravada has some big advantages because we have the Pali canon, which first of all is an Indian language. Yeah, so it's quite close to the original language, which is always a good thing. The more you translate things, the less you keep things intact. It's a full set of suttas. Yeah, the whole set of the four Nikayas is there. That's another very important factor in that. And generally speaking, if you look at the Theravada suttas, they seem to have been kept with in a very conservative fashion. Generally speaking, they seem to be more original than suttas from other schools. Yeah, not always, but generally. It doesn't mean that we cannot learn anything from other languages and schools. We can, but generally speaking, the Theravada is actually kept very well. So these are some of the reasons why the Theravada suttas are, or Theravada has some advantages, at least the scriptures that we have certain advantages. But I think it's nice to get away from this kind of one-upmanship, who is better, who is worse, and try to kind of see beyond that and see that any good Buddhist who is practicing in a good way, who has a kind heart, who is generous, and who is has these qualities, actually that's a wonderful thing. Yeah? And then we don't need to say, because we all think we are better. I mean, it's kind of natural that you think you're better. Otherwise, if you didn't think you're better, you choose something else. Yeah. So it's kind of natural to think that you're on the right track. Yeah? But also useful to kind of reduce that a little bit so we can have more harmony. Because sometimes you find Mahayana Buddhists who are better practicing than certain Theravada Buddhists. Yeah, it's not what you label yourself, it's how you live that really matters at the end. And there are people, all kinds of people around the world. There are Christians and Muslims and atheists and everything. Sometimes they are incredibly good people. And sometimes even Buddhists can learn from some people in these other religions. Of course, they can learn from us, we can learn from them. And when you look at the world like that, you take away some of the barriers between us, which can often be very useful. Okay, so that's a little bit about that. And let's go on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, I would like to thank you for your excellent teachings of the suttas again. I really appreciate the careful work you put into the suttas, present and the thorough and interesting way you present them. It is a very generous gift to us all and one for which we have great gratitude. I look forward to learning your teachings yet again next year. I am never bored. Okay, good. That's very nice. So next year we'll see what happens next year. Of course, coronavirus might create problems, yeah, but I guess there is a good chance. Yeah, once you have come a few times, there's always a good chance you will come back. So I think I'm already down for coming next year. So I've already committed myself. So I will. That should be happening. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you very much for your wise sermons. Sermons is a kind of very Christian word. When I hear the word sermon, I don't really think of what... I don't feel I'm giving sermons. But anyway, so I know what you mean. So that's very kind of you. So number one, talks, yeah. Number one, time permitting, will you be able to do a guided meditation session on death meditation, please, tomorrow? I already did get that before. Maybe you weren't present when it happened, yeah? I already tried that again, so not sure if there will be time tomorrow, because tomorrow we are going to end a little bit earlier than today. So probably unlikely, but it is recorded, probably. Are they recorded? Yeah, they are recorded. So you can probably listen to it online later on when it gets uploaded to the BSV website or whatever. Number two, how do we go about booking 2 or 3 weeks at Dhammasara or Bodhinyana Monastery? Our humble gratitude to both you, Venerable Ajahn Brahmali, and Venerable Ajahn Nissarano. How you go about? You go online and you go to the BSW website, and on there you go to the Bodhinyana or the Dhammasara sub-menu, wherever that is. And if you want to stay at Bodhinyana, there is a form right there on the website. You fill it in online and then you kind of fire it off, and then you get told when the next spot is available, yeah? Which is uncertain. Just to let you know, it is uncertain. Dhammasara, I'm not sure how you do it. Anyone know how you do it at Dhammasara? Is it a similar kind of thing? Is that, yeah? Same thing, online form. Okay, thank you, Burr, for coming. And now we good that you are here. So that's how you do it, yeah, similar kind of thing. So fill in the form online, and then you will hear from the guest monk or the guest nun, and they will let you know what happens next. There's also quite a bit of information on the website about what you can expect, what you should do, what you should bring, and et cetera, et cetera. So if you want to read up on that, it can be handy so that you know what you're going to. If it looks scary, well, then actually it's not very scary. Yeah, that's kind of just we're kind of trying to put people off a little bit so that they are really ready when they come. But actually, it's not very scary to live at the monastery here. Okay, dear Ajahn, unlike my Kalyanamitta, my preference is to be reborn female, a bhikkhuni, and contribute to the monastic gender equality. Okay, yay! No doubt with the support of male monastics and lay people, continuing Ajahn Brahm's courageous initiative. Ajahn, is there any age limit on male ordination at Bodhinyana Monastery? Following is a statement not requiring a comment from you. Okay. So what is this statement? Okay. NBM has reduced the entry age for females from 55 to 50 and now 45. My concern is that a woman would need to have a child by her age 27 if they choose to care for the child until 18 years old. Sadly, this may preclude many women from the option of ordination. As a gratitude for your profound knowledge and inspiring approach to the sutta, please return. Okay. With much metta to you and Ajahn Nissarano. Okay. Yes, that is true. I think ideally there should be no age limit in monasteries. At Bodhinyana, we don't actually have an age limit, but we try also to have a balance. We try not to have, it's nice to give young people a chance. And one of the main reasons why it's nice to give young people a chance is that they have a longer prospects, yeah, in the future. Yeah, and when you train them and you give them a chance, they may become teachers in the future, and they will kind of, be more valuable for the Buddhist community, perhaps, in the long run. It's nice to have at least some young people in the monastery, not everyone over 70. That kind of makes things more difficult sometimes. We have some of the monks over 70, and they are great monks, yeah? Some of them are untrainable, but they're very sweet anyway. So it's nice to have that. I like to have a monastery that is diverse. I think diversity creates a lot of goodness in a place. So some old monks, some young monks, some middle-aged monks, yeah? And that actually creates a very nice community. monks from all kind of backgrounds, yeah, monks from all kind of different countries and different cultures. I think that's really wonderful to have a monastery like that. So diversity in the Buddhist community, just like you see here, yeah, very diverse community. BSWA is very similar, also very diverse, and I'd like to see that reflected in the monastic community. That diversity, I think, is great. It makes us more tolerant and makes us better people when we have a lot of diversity, I feel. And in the Buddhist community, we all have the same goal, we have the same teacher, the Buddha. It's really nice to be able to work together like that. So we don't have an age limit, but that doesn't mean that age doesn't matter. Sometimes we do take that into account. We look at how many people we have already from a certain age group, and then we look a little bit at that. So I guess one of the reasons, again, why NBM has done that is because sometimes it is nice, you train young people, they will be around for a long time. Yeah, you kind of take these things into account. It sort of makes sense. Ideally, it shouldn't be like that. But when you have a limited number of spaces, sometimes you have to have some criteria to use to decide who to accept. And sometimes this becomes one of the criterions that you use, unfortunately. Okay, thank you both, Ajahns, from the bottom of our hearts for sharing your experience of the Buddha's profound teachings. Love from all of us. Okay, that is a very nice question. I like these kind of questions. very straight and point. That's very good. Okay, any more Buddhist jokes? I like that I've told you 1,000 times. Okay, I've told you 1,000,000 times. Don't exaggerate. That's it. That's a nice little one. Okay, that's it. End of questions. So tomorrow is another day. So we'll come back tomorrow and finish off the last few suttas. So have another good evening. And we'll see you back again tomorrow morning. This is Paid Respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha at the end.